Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI. Today we get the story behind a Valentine classic, those little Necco candy hearts with printed messages. They're the offspring of one of the oldest continuously manufactured products in the country. Their messages run the gamut from soppy Victorian poetry to the 90s, fax me. Wine maverick Joshua Wesson has the skinny on the next big grape. A hint, it starts with an M, just like Merlot, and great ones come from Argentina. Gourmet magazine's John Willoughby talks watercress. It's back to the 60s, at home with composer and conductor Leonard Bernstein, when his daughter Jamie shares meals, music, and memories. Then we go to a college that's earned the title Best Campus Food in America for 3 years running. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. That number is 800-537-5252. So let's get things rolling with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet magazine. So you two, where have you been?
We've been inside a cow skull.
What?
A giant cow skull by the side of the road north of Tubac and south of Tucson, Arizona, just off of I-19, exit 48. There is an entire building shaped like a bleached bone cow skull, longhorn cow skull, with great big horns sticking out either end and a kind of pile of earth and lizards behind it that are also part of the building.
The place is called the Longhorn Grill, and it's one of the very, unfortunately, fewer and fewer genre of roadside restaurants that look like something. There's the famous Mammy's Cupboard down in, where's that, Michael?
Mississippi.
In Mississippi, which, you know, looks like a...
You dine under the skirt of a mammy.
The skirt of a mammy. And then there are, like, in California near Palm Springs, there's the Eden the Brontosaurus place. But this is a giant replica of a cow skull with long horns. And you walk in the mouth, and then you sit down and...
Well, it's not really the mouth. You actually walk in what would have been the nasal cavity.
That's true.
I believe.
This is getting more attractive by the minute.
I know. Don't you want to eat?
It's really fabulous.
Just can't wait to hear about the menu.
We should just explain. Before we tell you what you're going to eat inside of this place, and by the way, it's not... ribs. It's not a bone-oriented menu. We have to tell you that the building itself has been there for years and years. When we first drove by about 10 years ago, it was a defunct real estate office. And we were driving by and we thought, well, let's see what happened to that cow skull. And it's been painted gleaming bleached bone white, and it's really neat and tidy inside. You sit down, there's a bar and several tables, and you sit down and order what actually is a very nice Southwestern meal.
In fact, it was such a fabulous building, and still is such a fabulous building, that when it was for sale, Michael and I actually considered buying it and relocating and living in it, because somehow it just seemed completely sternoid to live in a longhorn cattle skull.
I'm sorry.
You're speechless.
I'm thinking of your email address.
Care of the skull. Right.
Forget
our email address, our post office address.
All right, but...
Okay. You want to know what to eat.
Exactly. What is the food about?
Well, it's a combination of really good meat and potatoes. They have a whole menu of big, juicy steaks, 16-ounce sirloins, T-bones, and ribeyes with excellent, excellent French fries on the side.
So it is sort of homage de cow.
Well, I guess there are parts of cow to eat in there. On the other hand, there are other things on the menu. One of the things that we just loved was it's not even called Super Nachos. It's simply listed on the menu among appetizers as nachos. And we thought, well, let's get that. It's a little appetizer before we eat any meat. And it was gigantic. It was half the size of the table, the most Super Nachos I've ever seen.
And nachos down in that part of the world are, you know, I mean, ho-hum, who cares? Here is another plate of nachos. But these were distinguished by the excellent, excellent refried beans that were handmade in the kitchen and were kind of the glue that was the base of this giant plate of nachos.
Okay, we do steak, we do nachos, great fries inside of a steer skull.
We should also mention that there is a nice, wonderful, long bar there with a huge selection of tequila. So if you want to sit there and get ossified, that's the place to do it.
Or calcified.
Thank you, guys.
Bye.
Bye, Lynn. Now the toe and the foot bone join together, and the foot and the ankle bone join together, and the ankle and the leg bone join together, and the leg and the knee bone join together, and the knee and the thigh bone join together, and the thigh and the hip bone join together. Now hear ye the word of the Lord.
Gene and Michael Stern's latest book is Blue Plate Specials and Blue Ribbon Chefs. Now, every week you can hear them here on the Splendid Table, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. Joshua Wesson is a wine expert with his own agenda. He believes wine isn't about snobbery. He approaches it as an everyday beverage to be enjoyed in moderation. And he's always looking for a good buy. Joshua's the creator of Bestsellers Wine Shops. Josh, welcome back.
It's so good to be back here with you.
It's good to have you back. Let's talk about red wines. What's going on with red wines?
Ooh, you know, it's cold in New York right now, and I have been drinking a lot of red wines from Argentina because I think it's the next big thing, the next big place, and specifically Malbec from Argentina, which is the most widely planted red grape there. It's driving me crazy.
What is Malbec?
Actually, it's a French grape. It's spelled M-A-L-B-E-C, and at one time it was one of the most popular grapes in Bordeaux. But the folks in Bordeaux don't grow it often because it's such a pain in the tush. It's liable to get socked with frost and mildew and rot and all sorts of exotic grapevine diseases like couleur. And the Bordelais have a problem with it. But if you take it out of a place where it's a little bit damp and you stick it in a place where there's no rainfall and it's warm and sunny, like Argentina, you're going to end up with fantastic wines. And that's exactly what they have ended up with there.
What does it taste like?
Well, it's in France, it tastes like a rustic version of Merlot. It's not quite as smooth as Merlot, not quite as seductive. And it's got this positively, you know, rough-hewn backbone to it. And it can be quite tannic. But when it's grown in a place where it gets plenty of sun, it ends up trading in that tannic cloak for a lot more fruit. And it has these intense black fruit flavors, which are the things that just drive me crazy with delight, because I can never get enough of, you know, black currant and black cherry, especially when you're drinking wines in the, you know, the middle of the winter or early spring.
Okay. What should we be looking for in the wine shop?
Well, the good news is that Malbec is the most widely planted grape in Argentina. And Argentina is one of the top producing wine countries in the world, although it's sort of hidden away. People don't know about it. And you can find Argentine Malbecs pretty easily, and they're very inexpensive because there's so much of them produced. It used to be maybe 15 years ago that all the Malbec in Argentina was consumed by the Argentinians, but now the good stuff's coming over here, and some of my favorites are the Trapiche, which I absolutely love, and it sells for about $10 a bottle. Mm-hmm. And it will hold its own. It's a great wine to stick in a bag and give to California wine freaks, because they won't know where it's from, and they'll guess that it's $20, and then you'll be a hero when you pull it out of the bag.
All right, Trapiche. That's
and,
one.
And Santa Julia, which is even less expensive than the Trapiche. You can find it for $8 or $9, and it doesn't have the depth and complexity of the Trapiche, but at $8 or $9, it's just a hell of a good red drink.
Uh-huh. Any others?
Yeah, well, you know, people often think that Argentina and to a lesser extent Chile are basically places where you find inexpensive wines, and there's nothing good and expensive coming out of there, or I should say, there's nothing super complex. But in the last 10 years, there's been so much money funneled into both Chile and Argentina that the quality of the winemaking has zoomed up to the top of the wine world. And my favorite big ticket Malbec is from a small producer, Mapema, M-A-P-E-M-A, And this wine is just stunning. It's one of those wines, inky black, you put it in a glass, come back to it in about 10 or 15 minutes, mm-hmm. and you can't stop thinking about it. It haunts you because it's so impossibly, irrevocably delicious. And you can't say that about a whole heap of expensive red wines.
Is that the $20 to $30 bottle range?
Yeah, you can find it under $30, but it usually is sold for about $32, $33. Mm-hmm. And if you find it anywhere in a store, I urge you to seek it out because you will have one of those epiphanal wine experiences, and with a grape from Bordeaux originally, now in Argentina, that you never heard of. It's great. It's truly a new point in flavor.
What would we be drinking these wines with?
Well, the less expensive Malbecs tend not to have a lot of tannin. So you can have them with a wide range of foods. They're great with grilled fish. They're great with all kinds of grilled birds. You certainly can have them with meat, the way in Argentina they love to eat steak.
Mm-hmm.
And the Mapemo is the kind of wine that can hold its own with just about any full-on cut of meat, a leg of lamb or ossobuco. I mean, it's right up there with giant, beautifully constructed Bordeaux wines, top flight Cabernets from California and top flight Cabernets from Australia. This is a world-class wine, and it deserves to be put against a very simple piece of meat or some cheeses that are mild in flavor, so it can really be the star of the evening. Because mm-hmm. if you put that bottle on the table, it will be the star of the evening.
Do they need age? Can we age these wines?
The more expensive Malbecs certainly can take time in the bottle to mature. But the great news about a lot of red wines from Argentina and Malbec specifically is that they're good to go right out of the bottle. And I think the rule of thumb for listeners is if you're buying a Malbec from Argentina and it costs $15 or less, you can enjoy it immediately. It doesn't need to be put in front of an air conditioner. It doesn't need to have the cork pulled. You don't need to blow on it. It's just fantastic right out of the bottle. Sometimes I don't even use a bottle. I just put a nipple on there. But
okay.
That's me.
Josh, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Josh Wesson is president of Bestsellers Wine Shops. You can find his Malbec suggestions on our website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, the story behind a Valentine classic, At Home with Leonard Bernstein, and open lines for your calls. Reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show about life's appetites.
Candy, call me sugar candy, 'cause I am sweet on candy, and candy sweet on me.
What's one of the oldest, unchanged, continuously manufactured products in the country that went to the South Pole with Admiral Byrd to the tune of 2.5 tons and now sells $8 billion a year? It's Necco candy wafers and those little Necco hearts with messages on them that are made from the same recipe. We have Lori Zimbalati with us. She's marketing manager for the New England Confectionery Company, or Necco. Lori, welcome.
Thank you.
So, Lori, how did the company begin?
Well, actually, Necco was founded in 1847 by a young English immigrant named Oliver Chase, who invented a lozenge cutting machine and founded a company around it.
Now, where did the hearts with the messages start? How did that all begin?
The hearts date back to 1866. Oliver had a brother named Daniel, and he invented the printing process that allowed the saying to go on the candy.
Now, was that the first time people had ever seen a candy that spoke to them?
Actually not. Prior to that, there was a candy called Cockles, which was much like a fortune cookie, and the saying was on a piece of paper inside the candy.
Uh-huh. So those hearts, now they're now connected with Valentine's Day, and they began back in the 19th century. Was this what they looked like at that time?
Not exactly. At that point, they were a lot more elaborate. There was longer sayings on them, and they were in different shapes, curlicues, and they were in the shapes of watches and postcards. And they were a lot more elaborate then. A lot of work was done by hand.
Oh, really?
Huh. Yes.
What kinds of messages did they have back then?
Well, we had a few different ones. One was, "Married in white, you have chosen right." And some of our other ones that, again, are so elaborate, "I'd be happy if you knew that you always would be true." And, "Come, dearest, take a walk with me. I have a tale to tell you." Now, of course, nowadays, you know, you can fit four letters of two lines on the little hearts, so you're a lot more limited in what you can put on them.
So how have the sayings changed with the times?
The sayings have kept and changed with the times over the years. In the 50s, we had cha-cha. In the 60s, we had dig me. But the really big change was in 1996 when we introduced the first high-techie saying, fax me. And that caused quite a commotion. People loved it, hated it. They wrote us. They emailed us. They gave us angry calls, good calls. And that really started to kick off this changing of the sayings on a regular basis.
Now, where do the sayings come from?
The sayings come from many different places. We get hundreds of suggestions every year, almost 1,000 when we total them up. They come from school kids and teachers and parents and employees, and they all send them in to us. We read every single one. We compile them all. We sort through them at the end of the season for next year, and we decide which ones we like and that we'd like to put on the candy.
Whose job is it to do that?
Well, it's one of my jobs now. We used to have a King of Hearts who has subsequently retired, and that was his job. I head up the marketing team, and we review all the sayings. Everything gets looked at. Of course, some we have to call out because they're too long. But we do look at everything, and then we narrow them down to 8 to 10, which we change every year.
What's the most suggested? I mean, is there one saying that always comes up when people make these suggestions?
Well, everybody always likes "marry me." In fact, that's our most requested heart, because a lot of times when gentlemen propose, they want to put the candy heart in with the engagement ring. So during the year, we get a lot of requests. "Will you pick me out a marry me heart?" And we do accommodate them. So we like to encourage romance.
Well, what's new this year?
This year, we have 10 new sayings, and the first 6 are fashion sayings, and they are "look good," "tray chic," "vogue," "diva," "dress up," and "in style."
So fashion's a big thing this year. Huh.
Fashion is in. It's a great conversation starter. It's a great way to get into a romance, to tell someone how good they look.
What about the other new sayings?
The other new sayings were suggestions that came in from kids and adults. The most requested kids saying for this year, believe it or not, was "what's up." All of a sudden, we got like 20, 30, 50 of these suggestions, and we knew something was up. So that made it on. "That smile," "you are a cutie," which was another kid suggestion, and "two hearts."
Okay. Are there multiple language Nico hearts?
Yes, we actually do manufacture a Hispanic sweetheart box, which is newly designed this year with new sayings that's being marketed nationwide now.
Okay, well, happy Valentine's Day, and thank you.
Happy Valentine's Day to you and your listeners.
Lori Zimbalati is marketing manager for the New England Confectionery Company. Be sure to send your message ideas to her. Well, we've got a Valentine menu for you. I couldn't resist this. Of course, you know it's got to be Italian. What I've done is I've put together an entire menu for two. You've got a lovely light pasta with tomato sauce, balsamic chicken, a salad, and then my all-time favorite dessert, the sensual panna cotta, just pure cream on a spoon. Now, you can get the entire menu, all of the recipes, by going to the website, splendidtable.org. John Willoughby is what you might call a food writer's food writer. He's a solid researcher, a gifted recipe developer. He's done books with his pal Chris Slazinger that keep winning awards, and now he's executive editor at Gourmet Magazine. John, welcome.
It's great to be back, Lynn.
So what have you been working on?
Well, recently I've been using a lot of watercress.
Watercress?
Yeah, I think this is a vegetable. It's one of those vegetables that really doesn't get its true glory that it should have. I think people, when they think of watercress, tend to think of watercress sandwiches, and so they think it's a kind of an effete little herb that there's not much to do with. But it's actually very versatile. It's like it's got great flavor, and it's got a long history in both Europe and Asia as being used both raw and cooked in a lot of different ways. It's a lot like, you can use it a lot like you do radicchio or arugula, but it's less expensive. So I think it's a great thing to be cooking with.
Well, now you're really talking if you're talking about saving money and getting that kind of hit.
Always a good thing.
But you know, one of the things I see with watercress when I see it in the stores, often it's kind of beaten up. And I think people don't buy it because of that.
That's true. I think it is often not in the best looking condition in the store. But one thing about watercress is it is a very high percentage of water, so you can refresh it very quickly by putting it in very cold water, and then you put it in the refrigerator with its stems in a glass of cold water, and in a couple of hours it'll look totally different. So you shouldn't be too discouraged if what you see in the store doesn't look perfect.
So where does our watercress come from that we see in the stores?
Well, watercress is actually a big crop in the United States. It is grown all over the eastern seaboard, also in Hawaii, and it's now a year-round crop. It's the original hydroponic vegetable. Watercress grows with its roots in cold running water, and it used to be just a springtime thing. You could only get it in the spring, and pretty much only in New England where it was cool, but now it's commercially grown in a lot of locations all over the country, so you can get it year-round in good quality.
And it has that crisp, almost peppery kind of taste,
it's
right?
A nice peppery flavor, a little hot, and it's also a little bit astringent. So while it gives you a little heat, it also cuts richness. So I mean, we like to use it with pork and other sort of rich meats because it really works well with the richness of the meats. And you can use it raw as like a bed for meat, or you can also cook it. And it is about the most popular green in China, actually.
Really?
Yeah, it's funny. Its name in Chinese means Western water vegetable, but it is really popular
from
in
New
China.
England. Yes, yes, I saw
that. Full translation.
I read that Chinese character. I saw that. Yes.
But it is very popular there. Of course, they use it cooked because they almost always cook greens. But the interesting thing to me was that almost 30% of the watercress grown in this country is used by Chinese Americans. So what that means, one of the things that means is in this country, the watercress we get is bred with very large stems because that's good for cooking.
Right.
So it's great for stir frying. This is a wonderful vegetable to stir fry. It's got that nice, peppery, bold flavor. So you really get some taste with it. And it goes well with other Asian flavorings. That's a really great way to use it.
Okay. All right. We'll try the watercress, John.
I hope so.
Hey, John, thanks.
Thank you, Lynn.
John Willoughby is executive editor of Gourmet Magazine and is co-author with Chris Slazinger of How to Cook Meat. Now, you can get his recipe for watercress and endive salad with pears and blue cheese on our website, splendidtable.org. Jamie Bernstein Thomas grew up in a penthouse on Park Avenue in New York City, summered with the literati in Connecticut, and as the eldest daughter of Leonard and Felicia Bernstein, fell asleep at night with the tinkle of the piano, muffled laughter, and ice clinking in glasses.
My first decade as the eldest of Leonard and Felicia Bernstein's three children took place in the Osborne, a grand, sooty old building catty-cornered from Carnegie Hall, an easy commute for my father to his podium in front of the New York Philharmonic. My little brother Alexander and I would eat an early dinner in the kitchen in the company of Julia, our devoted, irascible nanny, and Rosalia, the cook. Rosalia and Julia were both from Chile, like our mother, so life in the kitchen was in Spanish. After dinner and bath came an escorted visit downstairs to Mummy and Daddy, where they were having drinks with their friends in a companionable nebula of cigarette smoke. We were permitted to chat and clamber for 10 or 15 minutes. Then, according to some unseen signal between Julia and our mother, it was time for us to go upstairs to bed. Alexander and I drifted off to sleep, listening to the steady waves of laughter, the clink and clatter of dinner, and later the piano playing and raucous singing. We knew the names and could picture their faces behind our closed eyes. Betty Comden and Adolf Green, Steve Sondheim, Mike Nichols and Isaac Stern, and Dick Avedon, and on and on. We didn't really get it about our father's fame until the night the Flintstones went to the Holly Rock Bowl and Betty Rubble said, "Oh, I just love to watch Leonard Bernstein conduct." That's when we knew Daddy had really hit the big time. Part of our mother's secret recipe for combining comfort and elegance was the delicious Chilean food that she served at her parties, prepared by an ever-changing cast of talented, high-strung South American cooks. We were particularly fond of filching Anita's cheese-filled mini empanadas, deep-fried and piping hot, so that when you bit through the crispy dough, you instantly burned your tongue on the heavenly melted cheese inside. Everyone at those parties would talk while huffing cool air through their mouths. In the middle of everything, President Kennedy was assassinated. We had never seen grown-ups act like this. They still gathered, still smoked and drank, in fact, more than ever, but it was different. They were distracted and tetchy. They watched television all day long. We were all in the library watching TV together when Jack Ruby pumped Lee Harvey Oswald full of lead. Our parents were electrified. They couldn't stop talking about it, any of it. Mummy and Daddy read every assassination conspiracy book the minute it appeared. Then they had to hide them all the following summer when Mrs. Kennedy herself came to our Connecticut house for the weekend with Caroline, John John, and 2 station wagons full of Secret Servicemen. There were some pretty good moments in that weekend, given the basic inescapable tension of the visit. But the standout event came early Saturday morning when 4-year-old John John wandered out to the driveway, unnoticed by 8 Secret Service men. He climbed behind the wheel of one of the station wagons, released the emergency brake, and hopped nimbly out of the car as it rolled down the hill and crashed into a copper beech tree, which bears the scar to this very day. The shadow came down on us again in 1968 with the double losses of Martin Luther King and then Robert F. Kennedy. Maybe being a grown-up wasn't so much fun after all. They seemed exhausted, haunted, beyond reach. In the sad afterdust of September 11th, I've become one of them. But this is what I now remember. My siblings and I could concentrate on tragedy for only so long. Then we had to escape into the safety of our own in-jokes and make-believes, just as my kids do today. Throughout those sad, scary times when I was growing up, our mother kept the house open to one and all. There was comfort there, in the music, the hugs, the healing Chilean soups, comfort in Daddy's earthiness, and in Mummy's wit and grace. Together, the two of them conjured a kind of radiance, and for a time, it seemed all the world came to warm themselves at their hearth.
Jamie Bernstein's article, A West Side Story, appeared in the February 2002 issue of Gourmet magazine. The lines are officially open for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to the phones. We have Chris on the line. Chris, what do you want to talk about?
I've built a couple of small houses, and I'm going to build another one that is described probably best as a cabin or a cottage, and I'm interested in making a small, efficient kitchen.
Uh-huh.
And I cook, but I am not a gourmet cook. I am by myself, so I don't need a kitchen bigger than a one-person size. I'm wondering if there are any kitchen design books that talk about efficiency in the same sense that the Cornell School of Economics used to talk about the work triangle.
The famous work triangle between the refrigerator, the stove, and the sink.
Correct.
Yeah, which, by the way, a lot of designers now say doesn't apply if you have more than one person, and they're rethinking it and all that. Are you a builder? Do you build and sell, or do you build houses for yourself?
I build houses for myself, and then when I get, it turns out when I get done, I sell them and move on and apply what I've learned in the past to the new construction, so... That's what I'm trying to do now, is learn more in particular about kitchens.
About kitchens.
Tending to cook more as I get older.
So you're looking for designs for kitchens that are small and very efficient, not necessarily, you know, filled with fancy, expensive equipment?
Exactly.
Okay. All right. This is two things come to mind. One is a book by an architect whose name I always mispronounce, but the book is called The Not Too Big House.
Yeah, Sarah Susanka.
Thank you. I always think of her as Sarah Susquehanna.
Ah!
Sarah Susanka. Thank you. Thank
right.
you.
Has that
you've read it. Okay. You know the other place I would go for what I think of as real world kitchen design ideas?
Mm-hmm.
Better Homes and Gardens Publications.
Really?
Yes. You know why? They have the resources to test, try stuff out. They are dealing with readers who often do not feel like spending $5,000 for a stove,
right.
you know, or installing a wood-fired oven.
Right.
I have found that they are really right on when it comes to realistic kitchen designs.
So they might have a website as well.
They probably do. And the other thing is, you know what I would do? I would talk to cooking teachers in your area.
Okay.
And I'm thinking of this because I am one myself.
Mm-hmm.
People who have spent much of their time in a kitchen often have some real practical ideas.
Oh, yeah.
For what
Absolutely.
Works. You know, for instance, you never want a two-tiered or multi-tiered island. It is the greatest waste of space. You see people with these, you know, islands that are divided into steps. You want to drive yourself nuts, or you want to have accidents, that's the way to do it. You want the largest flat open surface you can have so you can spread out.
Uh-huh.
Don't chop up your counter space if you can avoid it.
Right.
Give yourself as much elbow room and clear space as you can.
Right.
So at any rate, I think those are two sources.
Right.
Okay.
Thanks
and by
much.
The way, one other one, Family Circle. Again, the same concept, dealing with a lot of real world problems.
I'll be darned. Okay.
I mean, I know. You don't think of that. You think of the fancy stuff, but I think they're really great.
Great.
Hey, good luck. And
thank you.
I'd love to know how it all turns out.
All right.
Okay.
Bye.
Well, it's time for our weekly trivia question. Here it is. What's the newest way of getting the morning weather report? We're going to have that answer in a moment and more of your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. We've opened the lines for your calls this hour. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. But before going back to the phones, I've got the answer to this week's trivia question. Here it is. The question was, what's the newest way of getting the morning weather report? And the answer is, from your toaster. Now, this is straight from the New York Times. An industrial design student in England has created a toaster that sears the weather forecast into your morning toast. For sunny, it's a circle with rays sticking out, a cloud for cloudy, and raindrops for the obvious. His name is Robin Southgate, and his gadget works with a microprocessor in the toaster that's connected via telephone to a web server. A Stencil brands the toast. It's called Toasty, and the prototype runs $2,150, but at the moment there is no plan to mass-produce the toaster. That's going to change because I'm calling Target. Okay, back to the phones. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Okay, who's next? Let's see. Ah, we've got Frank on the line. Frank, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Ellen. This is Frank Green. I have a question for you. My wife considers herself pretty much of a gourmet cook, but I have a challenge that has kind of blown her brain. I'm looking for a recipe for stuffed raspberries. Specifically, I look at that little tiny hole in a raspberry and think, gee, what a wonderful dessert that would be. I've tried just filling it with chocolate mousse, but there's got to be some better way to do it, both in terms of what you put in it, how you put it in it, and how you present it.
Well, the best way to do it, the physical way to do it, would be to use a pastry bag with a very fine pastry tip on it. You know, one that has a very small hole, and then you just squeeze and release and squeeze and release, and you filled it. But there's nothing in the world better than raspberries and cream. And I'd whip the cream, if you want to get fancy, okay, you whip the cream with a little bit of sugar, and you scrape the inside of a vanilla bean into that cream.
Vanilla bean.
Yeah, because vanilla and raspberries are truly a combination that probably was originated in the celestial area. It's just incredible. And so a little bit of that cream, and of course what's nice is, you know, the whipped cream will make a little crown on top of the individual raspberry. But don't ask your wife to do this if she's cooking the entire meal. You take this on.
Well, she refuses to do it. I've done this several times using almond paste and, like I said, chocolate mousse, and replace half the recipe of chocolate mousse with brandy.
This is not shabby either. Try the cream. It's a very simple thing, but it also lets the raspberries be the star, and see what you think.
Okay. And any thoughts on? I mean, just lay them on a plate, put them on a green leaf.
You know what would be really pretty is if you can get shiny, you know, crisp-looking leaves. I'm thinking of things. Where do you live, Frank?
Knoxville, Tennessee.
Well, maybe you're in warm enough climate. I'm thinking about lemon leaves. You know, citrus tree leaves, something that's really shiny, and then you could arrange a cluster of raspberries on each leaf and sort of trail them down a long, narrow platter.
Yeah, okay.
That would be kind of classy.
Wonderful. Yeah.
You know, Frank, this really isn't such a bad idea after all. I'm sorry I teased you about
okay. Hey, thank you very, very much.
Okay, all right.
Bye-bye.
Okay, let's see who's up next. We've got Dennis calling. So, Dennis, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. First of all, what's the difference between fowl, game, and poultry? I could, and I have looked them up in a dictionary, but cookbooks seem to use these words like almost interchangeably. Vis-a-vis cooking, are they interchangeable?
Gee, you know what? That's a good question, and I'm not sure. This is purely, you know, what I think, and I don't have a dictionary in front of me. When poultry, to me, embraces anything that has wings, but usually I associate it with domesticated things like turkey, domestic duck, chicken, etc. When I think of fowl, the first thing that comes to mind is wild winged creatures.
Oh, I see where you're
going. Yeah, like waterfowl or whatever. But I do know that older chickens are often referred to as fowl. As well.
And also there's game birds.
And there's game birds, which
I think
where
you're going with this thought. Though.
Yeah, and then game to me embraces everything, but you could say game's about something with, you know, with four legs.
Yeah.
But, you know, usually when you say game, that can embrace everything, whether it flies or it walks or it creeps or whatever. Mm-hmm. So it is very confusing.
Yeah,
it's a good
is.
Question. Now I'm going to have to go and look it up and see. And then the problem is where you look it up. You know, is it a really reliable source for
exactly.
that?
Exactly. I've got a cooking dictionary. I've got a couple of regular dictionaries.
Yeah.
And they don't agree.
Oh, good. This is the kind of thing I can do at 2 o'clock in the morning. This is good. You're keeping me out of trouble.
All right. Well, thank you, and keep it up.
Hey, Dennis, thank you.
Bye-bye.
You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Let's see now. Who's up next? Oh, Teresa is calling. So, Teresa, what's happening?
I am calling about roasted peppers.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I've recently tried some recipes for chili rellenos and used the poblano peppers. And they do take a little bit of while to peel them after you've charred them. And I wondered if you could do them ahead and how long you could do them ahead. How far ahead could you do them?
Well, first of all, you could probably do them hours ahead, certainly.
Mm-hmm.
Hours ahead, because the whole thing with the chili rellenos is that you roast the pepper, you cut it in half, you peel it, and then you stuff it, and then you fry it.
Right.
And it's really, you know, sort of you're stuffing it. It's almost like a cheese. It's a fried cheese fritter, essentially.
Right.
It's so delicious.
But I've also done some with a meat stuffing, too.
Oh, you can do. You can stuff that pepper with anything you
yes.
want. Yeah, exactly. But you could certainly do it in the morning for the evening.
Okay.
I wouldn't doubt you could do it a day ahead. I've just never gotten around to it. The other thing is, I don't know if this helps you, because I know a poblano does not like to give up its skin. And those of you who have never seen a poblano pepper, it's a glossy, when it's fresh, it's a glossy, beautiful, dark green pepper that's probably about, 5 or 6 inches long. And it's kind of a triangular shaped pepper. And it's not ever terribly hot, but it can be really meaty.
Yes.
And it's delicious. Sometimes it's hard to peel, but there's a little trick. Maybe you've done this. You roast it, you know, over a flame, over your barbecue, or under the broiler until
right.
it's charred on all sides. And then stick it in a paper bag.
Yes, I made the mistake of putting it in a plastic bag.
Oh, dear. Oh, yeah.
Ooh. And I melted a hole in the plastic bag.
You are
bag.
In such excellent company, I can't tell you. Do you want to know about the time I used the plastic string to wrap my roast?
Oh.
That was really a moment we will never forget. It took us 2 weeks to get the smell out of the kitchen.
Oh dear!
But the point here is, if you stick it in the plastic in the paper bag, and let it sit for about 45 minutes or an hour, sometimes it's just easier to separate the
right.
The
and
skin.
I've also read you can just put them down in a bowl and put a towel over
yeah,
them.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Yes. It just helps that.
It's
that
just
skin.
If you wanted to do more than just a couple or three, it would take you quite a long time. So
but
that's
I'd say,
why I was.
Do it a day ahead. I don't think you're going to have any sacrifice in
and
quality.
And just keep them in the fridge,
that's
though, right.
right. Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
Okay. Thank you, Leanne.
This sounds good.
All right.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. You can call us at 800-537-5252. Let's see. Who has been waiting? Well, we've got Andrew calling. So, Andrew, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I wanted to say that I was calling, actually, because I just got back from an amazing trip. Just spent 3 weeks in Paris and then Senegal in West Africa.
Really? What a combination. How did that come about?
Well, Paris was the route to Senegal. And, of course, it was, you know, another terrible thing, having to spend a couple of days in Paris and a couple of days on the way back. And the question I have coming out of it was papaya.
Oh.
We would have, for dessert in many places, a fresh papaya with just lime sprinkled over the top.
It's the best way to eat a good papaya.
My question is, how do I find a good ripe papaya?
Oh, boy. Well, it sounds like you were in a place where they're growing them.
Yes.
And some of us have been lucky enough to be in places where they grow them. When I was in Hawaii, and there was the Honor papaya stand. It was literally a grove of papaya by the road. There was a little can, coffee can, that had prices. You know, big papaya costs 50 cents, small one, 25. And you would go and either pick it yourself or take it off the table and pay for it. And I had never, I'd always thought papaya was good. This was unbelievable. And I think one of the keys is, you see, papaya is generally picked unripe. For obvious reasons. You have to ship it. When it's very ripe, it's fragile. There's evidently a fruit fly that can get to it as well when it gets to be ripe. I'd say that the season is generally spring, from what I recall. Spring and I think fall. And I think the less it has been shipped, or if it's been shipped from the Caribbean, where supposedly this fruit fly isn't as much of a problem, so they can let it ripen a little more. And I think you want to get it quite ripe, which means put it on a dark counter, not in the sunlight at all, okay, but on a counter, or put it in a plastic bag or a paper bag. Better a paper bag, because you want it dark, with a banana in it, because the banana throws off a gas that helps it ripen. And it'll be ripe when it has the give of an avocado. You know how a ripe avocado has a little softness to it?
Right.
That's how you know the papaya is ripe. And when you buy a papaya, there are many, many different kinds of papaya. The one I see most often is yellow with some green. You want it more yellow than green.
Okay.
And for anyone who has never seen a papaya, the flesh can range from sunset orange to this gorgeous gold. And when you slice it in half, I think it is the single most beautiful fruit, because it has big, glossy, black seeds that look like beluga caviar on steroids. It is the single most gorgeous thing. Just sit out a bunch of them on a platter, because it's a centerpiece. But that's what I would do. And the other thing is, get as close to the source as you can, because
okay,
you were spoiled. You were eating beautiful papaya. But try that approach, especially with springtime. You know, it's going to work well.
Okay.
Hey, thanks for sharing the adventures, Andrew.
Sure, no problem. Thank you.
Okay, goodbye.
Bye.
I've got a thought for you. Outstanding food in a college cafeteria? Not likely, except at the College of the Atlantic. It's a liberal arts school in Bar Harbor, Maine. It has been singled out for best campus food for 3 years in a row by a publication called The 331 Best Colleges. It comes out of the Princeton Review. Well, we have Steve Katona on the line. He is president of the College of the Atlantic. President Katona, thank you for talking with us.
Hi, Lynn.
Okay, what is a typical cafeteria lunch like at the College of the Atlantic?
Well, I can tell you what lunch is today. And it is typical. Today there's a Turkish-style vegan stew, recipe from Vegetarian Times magazine. There's a Senegalese vegetable and fish stew, which is from a rice cookbook. There is jasmine rice, curried cauliflower, some leftover Brunswick chicken stew, which is from Camille Glenn's Southern Cooking cookbook. There's some leftover haddock sandwiches, fish from last night's dinner. These are local fish, local haddock, caught by fishermen here out of Bar Harbor. Fried tofu and cookies, or oatmeal raisin, marble cookies, and almond butter cookies. Those are vegan. And pumpkin raisin pound cake. So that's today's lunch.
I'm ready to go back to school. And also, only a college would actually document the source of the recipe. But why this emphasis on food?
Well, here at the College of the Atlantic, our mission is to train students in what we call human ecology, which is the relationship between people and environment, both the natural environment and social environment. And there's an intentional quality to the college, too, which is to try and improve our relationships to the social world and to the natural world. And, you know, one of the most important things about human existence is food and how we get it, how we make it, where it comes from, what the costs are, both financial and to the environment, and what the benefits are and costs to ourselves in terms of health and all the other things that food can do for us.
Well, who's actually doing the cooking?
Well, our head chef is Donna Skill. Our baker is Jill Miller. We've got a vegan chef, Valerie Radziewicz, and an assistant chef, Mark Haggerty. We've got an evening assistant, Lynn Berzinis, and a dining room manager, Alexa Pisano, who's one of our graduates.
Uh-huh.
And Sarah Landry is our evening prep cook and dishwasher. And all of these people work together to create menu. And they take suggestions from students, do their very best to make a dish that a student really liked at home, because, you know, people do get homesick when they're away from college.
Mm-hmm.
And in particular, our international students who come from, all around the world, love to have something that reminds them of home. So this evening, for example, our Czech student is giving a talk on Czechoslovakia and also later showing a movie from Czechoslovakia. So she talked to the kitchen, and they prepared a Czech dinner. So tonight there's potato latkes and potato soup and roast pork.
Oh, this is lovely.
Meatloaf and lentil loaf and cabbages, all kinds of things. And for dessert, prune strudel.
Do the students participate at all in the cooking?
Oh, yeah, they participate in every way. They do help in cooking. Many students fulfill their work-study requirements or by working in the kitchen, either preparing food or serving or cleaning up the dining hall or washing dishes. And also they participate in the farm by helping to grow some of the vegetables that we eat at our organic farm. And also, and perhaps this is one of the most important things, they help to generate ideas for recipes and also to evaluate the food. There's a book, a comment book, that's kept in the kitchen, and it gives feedback and really is a wonderful way for the students to communicate with the dining hall staff.
How large is the school? How many students?
Well, the school has now about 255 students, and we're growing to about 300.
Well, President Katona, thank you for talking with us.
Well, it's a pleasure. I hope you'll come visit us sometime and have lunch or dinner here.
You're on.
Okay. Thanks, Lynn.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. Steve Katona is president of the College of the Atlantic in Bar Harbor, Maine. Now, in addition to being named Best Campus Food, the school ranked second in happiest students and third for most politically active. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. Until next week, let me leave you with this political advice from Frank Zappa. He said, "You can't be a real country unless you have a beer and an airline." To get information on any of the guests you heard here today, simply mail a self-addressed stamped envelope to The Splendid Table, care of Minnesota Public Radio, St. Paul, Minnesota 55101. That's The Splendid Table, care of NPR, St. Paul, Minnesota 55101. Or take a look at our website. That address is splendidtable.org. Check out The Splendid Table store while you're at it. You'll find it right there on our homepage. The Splendid Table is produced by Sally Swift. Our associate producers are Jennifer Lupke and Jennifer Russell. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed nationwide by Public Radio International. Be sure to join us next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
PRI, Public Radio International.